We continue with break the regulation. Jane.
Good morning, everybody. Today we're looking at paper 9. And in this paper, we've responded to some of the clarifying questions that were raised in last month's board meeting. In particular, in paragraphs 6 to 15 of the paper, we've refined the summary of how the rate regulator intervenes in both the activities the entity needs to carry out in order to satisfy the regulatory requirements, and also the basis for setting the rate that's charged for to customers to provide them with compensation in exchange for satisfying those regulatory requirements. In particular, in paragraphs 12 and 13, we've identified two components of the regulated rate: an amount that satisfies, that reflects the satisfaction of the regulatory requirements or the delivery of goods and services during the period at the amounts estimated for that period. But secondly, a component that reflects the origination and reversal of estimation variances and of temporary differences that arise when the regulated rate in one period includes an amount that relates to required activities carried out in a different period, so timing types of differences. The rate adjustment mechanism that we've described in defined rate regulation reflects the second of those components and is, in our view, an essential characteristic of defined rate regulation that creates the supplementary rights and supplementary obligations that the model looks to recognise as assets and liabilities. In paragraphs 22 to 42, we explain why we consider the other characteristics, as well as the rate-setting mechanism, support our conclusion that these supplementary rights and obligations do meet the definition of an asset or a liability as we expect those terms to be defined in the forthcoming revisions to the conceptual framework. We've also outlined in paragraphs 43 to 54 why we are focusing on those supplementary rights and obligations and looking to develop a model to recognise just that component of the rate regulation rather than looking to amend IFRS 15 or looking to develop an intangible asset model for the wider effects of the rate regulation. We're not asking the board to make any decisions in this meeting. Instead, in paragraph 59, we ask if you have any further clarifying questions to help us to make the basis for the model and the description of the model as clear as possible, and to help support our discussions in the next meeting when we plan to discuss the timing of the reversal of these regulatory amounts and also their presentation, particularly in profit or loss. And with that, I'll open and invite comments from.
Thanks, Jane. I just wanted to test a little bit the application of the concepts in the paper, and maybe using a simple example for illustration because it helps me, and focusing maybe on the definition of a liability and whether there's an obligation to transfer an economic resource. And the situation that I was thinking about would be one where, say, super simplistically, that the entity is allowed to charge or recover its costs and then make a profit of 100, and it estimated in the period that it was going to have costs of 1,000, it could make a profit of 100, so it was allowed to charge 1,100. Come along at the end of the year and it actually turns out that the costs were only 950 instead of 1,000. So next year, rather than making a profit of 100, they have to make up for the fact they charged too much last time, so they're only going to make a profit of 50 rather than 100 next time around, so there's an adjustment for that. So usually when we look at liabilities, it would be either the sort of simple example where I borrowed money, so I've got my resources up front and now I've got an obligation to pay back, or I've got something like an executory contract where I've got an obligation to perform a right to receive, but it's an onerous contract because there's an imbalance between the two. But in the case that I just went through, if I look at it as a whole, the entity has certainly got an obligation to deliver services, and it's got a right to receive, and it's got a right to receive less than it wanted to receive, but it's still making a profit of 50, so it's not an onerous contract. And I just wanted to understand where whether that lines up with this concept of having an obligation to transfer an economic resource, that part of the liability definition.
Thanks, Sue. Yeah, I think this is an area that lots of people have questions around, and I think it comes back to what we've got in particular paragraphs 12 and 13, where we're trying to break out the components of the regulated rate into that amount that's based on the estimates for the period that relate to what we're going to deliver in the period to the customers, versus the second component, which is the rate adjustment mechanism that we're focusing on. And I think if we were talking about just an adjustment to that first component, I think you're right, that would be the executory contract type of component of the arrangement, where we wouldn't be looking to book a liability unless it was an onerous amount. But I think this is maybe a unit of account type of situation, where what we're trying to look at in the model is that second component, and linking it to the definition of a liability, where we've already received some benefit because we've already received the amount that we've charged to the customers during the period. And if it's a timing type of difference that we talk about in paragraph 13b2, I think you mentioned it there, Sue, about we've got a service type of obligation. We've been paid in advance for something that we haven't actually done yet. So we would expect to book a liability there, even if it's not an onerous type of contract.
So you're sort of looking at it in two parts. So it would be as if the contract with the customer, absent the regulatory agreement, would be that I could charge $1,100. But I'm only allowed to charge $1,050. So you're thinking of the contract, even though it's bundled up into one payment of $1,050, of being a sort of payment from the customers of $1,100, and then this arrangement with the regulator that's the $50, and it's the $50 that you're looking at as the liability.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the same goes with the estimation kind of variances in 13b1, where if we just had that two-way relationship with the customer and the entity without the intervention of the rate regulator and the rate adjustment mechanism, we would probably be expecting to refund that excess compensation through either a credit note or a cash refund. If the contract had said it was, you know, the amount initially charged was an estimate and there would be a true-up adjustment at the end of the contract. In this case, I would say that we still have that refund type of obligation, but instead of giving a credit note or giving a cash refund that we would book as a payable liability, in this case, the regulator is effectively saying you have to net that off the amounts that you're going to be billing in the future periods. I think that just gives the regulator the mechanism for helping to provide the stability and predictability of the rates that we talk about in paragraph 10, so that customers are not surprised by a retrospective adjustment to their bills that they've already settled during the period.
Ms. Farsley?
Well, I think the paper refined the model step after step, and I think it's useful time spent be able to develop things further. So I think I would want to first highlight that continuing progress. I have no issue regarding whether those regulatory adjustments would be assets and liabilities, because to me they are either very similar to payments in advance received in IFRS 15 or receivables or work in progress in a long-term contract. In terms of whether they meet the assets and liabilities definitions, that's exactly the way I see them. And as a result, there is one point where I have doubts. In fact, it relates to paragraph 39 in particular. And more generally, when you analyze the effect that the limitations on entry into an industry may have, in paragraph 39, you suggest that these limitations could have an impact on whether the asset definition could be met, because the regulatory agreement would keep benefits away from others. And I don't think, because of what I've just said, I don't think that verifies. I think it's the control that the entity has is largely because it has performed under the agreement, and I don't think that the limitations that exist have a role to play in that area. You also, in the paper, suggest that this could have an effect on the scope, and I would like this to remain a question open, because it may have to play a role on the scope, but it also could simply have a role to play on recognition measurement. So I would like this question to remain open for the time being.
Gary?
Thank you. I think a really good paper, Jane. And actually, I liked how you wove in the conceptual framework, since we wrote that to assist us. I think this is the first practical use of it, at least of the almost final exposure draft. So I thought it was well not done. Building, and before I get to my question, the other thing, I think the regulatory agreement is key. There's a lot of places in the world that got rate regulated. You know, the London Black Cabs, for example, and hospitals, but they don't have a regulatory agreement. I think that's what scopes this down to a very limited number of entities, and as opposed to everybody that's got a rate regulated price. But using the numbers and the example Sue had, and this works better perhaps when you owe money as opposed to you're getting a, if you didn't have the regulatory agreement, but you had a cost plus contract with the end customer, you would get the same result, wouldn't you? You would just estimates. And so just try to keep this thing, I think overall is actually fundamentally fairly simple, you know, but think of it as it's just a cost plus when you're, again, it works better when you're on one side of the thing, but just, it's cost plus.
And I think that's what I tried to sort of portray in my response to Sue, in that if we're just looking at it from that two-way relationship, if the contract was to say that it was a cost plus based on the estimates, I don't think there'd be any question. The difficulty we've got here is that three-way relationship.
Yeah,
in that looking at one side, it's not a cost-plus contract, well, it's just fixed.
But yeah, well, it works
other,
that way for the first year, because there's no reversal on the cost-plus. You just have a true-up after after the period end.
Doug?
Thank you. Francois mentioned paragraph 39, but I think the limitation plays a very important role. Without limitation by the government, then we can't say there is a significant asset. And regarding the nature of this asset, I agree that this is not the intangible asset as defined in IS 38. I agree with your argument. So I think you intend to create new types of asset, which is not intangible, which is not something like account receivable, but it's you are going to create new type of asset, which is regulatory asset or something like that. Then if that is the case, the big question is it really meets the definition of the asset in the new conceptual framework? Maybe it may not in the previous current conceptual framework, but in the new conceptual framework, it may be. That's why we are going to go ahead. However, the point you mentioned in paragraph 34 is the key, especially the last paragraph. You said, although the economic resources derive its value from its existing potential to produce future economic benefit, the economic resources is the existing right, not the future economic benefit. And that's why you think it meets the definition of the asset, and I agree with that. Having said that, if that is the case, then the rights already exist. When the regulator gave a license to those rate-regulated industry, because the limitation itself is, in a sense, source of the rights. Because there is a limitation of the industry, so you don't have real significant competitor. So once you have the right to charge, then you can keep that ratio. That's the source of the value. Then the value in itself came from the license given to the rate-regulated industry. So therefore, you are talking only about adjustment side of those rights, but you are not really addressing the value of the underlying asset which was given when the government gave a license to the rate-regulated industry. So on this point, I just want to hear how you value those the asset which was given at the inception.
Okay, I think probably the best way to do is kind of break this down into into pieces. I think in terms of the nature of this asset, although we said in the paper we're not trying to build an intangible asset model, we're not kind of making judgments on the nature of the asset itself in terms of saying whether it's an intangible or not. It's not a financial asset because it doesn't quite meet the definition, although it's got many characteristics, I think, of financial assets, but it doesn't get into IFRS 9. It doesn't meet the definition of any other category of asset that we have, such as PP&E or inventory. There's a debate about whether it does meet the definition of an intangible asset or not. But I think in terms of terminology, if we can avoid calling it an intangible asset, it kind of takes away some of the confusion where people would then look to IAS 38 and the accounting requirements of 38. So I just think it's just a lot easier and less confusing if we just call it a regulatory asset, just to take it out of the model that's in IAS 38. In terms of the value, etc., I think it touches on what Francoise has said about it. The right is that we've got this right to charge because of what we've done so far. And that right is ours and ours alone. It's not shared by anybody else in the marketplace. But in terms of the valuation, I think that comes into the recognition and the measurement with the limitations on the competition is going to help in terms of the collectability, if you like, of the value that's associated with the right that we've got to increase our charge in the future. And so when we come back and talk about both scope and uncertainty, then that's where we'll wrap that into that conversation about how the limitation on the market contributes to the value. And in terms of the underlying license itself, I think already in IS 38 we've got the situation where if a company has to purchase a license or has to pay a renewal fee for the license, then that is captured by IS 38 and the company would recognise that as an intangible asset at its cost in the same way as it would do for any other type of license that it would acquire. But in those situations where the companies are not paying for the license, they're not paying to renew the license, there would be nothing under IS 38 to recognise.
Yeah. I do understand the limitation of IS 38, so therefore I agree this is not the intangible asset as defined in the IS 38. But IS 38 was made based on the current conceptual framework, and we are going to change the conceptual framework, and now we are saying that because of the change of the conceptual framework, now it's possible to recognize regulated assets.
Is that what we're saying? I don't think so.
I don't think so. No.
Right. If that is the case, it's fine. But somehow, you know, reading from your paper, it seemed like, you know, although we had a lot of difficulty with the rate-regulated assets, now it's possible to define rate-regulated asset, largely because we have changed some words.
I don't think that's it.
But that is what I interpreted the paragraph 34. You are saying that potential can be an asset. That's why we can recognize rate-regulated asset as an asset. So then my question, if that is the case, then how about principal underlying assets, which was given when the license was given?
I don't think we want to take a position really on whether we would have got to the same answer on the old framework, because it's not really a particularly relevant question for us to answer, I think. I think we think the new framework makes it easier for us to ask the right questions, but that's a different story.
And I think in terms of the scope of this project, the scope of the project is to focus on what are the characteristics of rate regulation that, that may create rights and obligations that are not already being recognised as liabilities. Whereas I think the scope of what you're saying there, Tech, is all intangibles, which would really just blow out the scope of the project.
Françoise?
Well, I sympathise with Tech's attempt at identifying, qualifying what are the animals that we're looking at. And frankly, it may be practical to refer to that to regulatory assets and liabilities. At the same time, it doesn't convey any substance to people. So you may remember, in fact, one recommendation I made at the last meeting that maybe it would be useful to divide and analyze the types of adjustments into revenue adjustments on one side and the cost capitalization effect on the other. I said at the time that I thought it would be helpful in order to make sure that we adopt recognition measurement element consistent with what we have done elsewhere. But I also think that it would help people understand what we are tackling.
Yeah. What would help?
Help people understand what we are tackling.
Identifying what the drivers are.
Whether it's a revenue adjustment.
Revenue adjustments on one side and capital.
What's causing the true ups?
And that's what we've suggested in.
That's where we want.
I think we've suggested in paragraph 57, that's what we're hoping to bring to the next meeting, an analysis of what's driving these supplementary rights and obligations and seeing if we can get a clearer picture of the nature of what we're recognising.
Stephen.
I'd like to go back to Gary's comment or his analogy with cost plus and just develop it a little further, because to my mind there's sort of two alternative ways in which the plus can be structured. Suppose I have a single contract with a customer and it's cost plus. And the true-up to get to the correct plus, depending upon what I've spent, is an adjustment with that customer. So the customer has to pay more, or I refund some of the consideration. Then there's no problem, because we will just, that is a receivable or a payable, and it doesn't matter about regulatory accounting or whatever, it's done. But let's suppose the cost plus agreement says, for this contract, you pay this, but will true up to get to the right cost plus with a future contract that that customer has with me. So if the customer buys another item in the future, then the transaction price of that future contract is adjusted to true up the profit on the previous contract. Now that doesn't qualify for asset or liability. And it won't. So outside regulatory accounting, if this was just a normal revenue recognition transaction with a customer, we wouldn't show that as an asset or liability, because it is not something we control, because it depends upon the customer buying some more goods or services from me. It may be that they buy these things every month. It may be that I'm the only supplier. It may be I have a monopoly, but we still wouldn't recognize that as an asset or liability under IFRS 15 or any other standard. So what is it about this that differentiates from that situation? So we end up adding in the regulator, but other than that, it's exactly the same as the situation that I've just described.
Well, you're assuming that there are no explicit or implicit rights and obligations beyond the parties. You're assuming that the supplier, out of the goodness of its heart, decides to enter into a, or to change the terms of future contracts as a result of what's already happened.
Well, no. The agreement I have with the first contract is that it's cost plus. So whatever I spend in delivering these goods and services, I can add on 100. But that the true up comes later. So we estimate the cost. We estimate the cost as 1,000, profit of 100. The contract is for 1,100. But the contract also says that we can true up that contract to an actual profit of 100 as a by adjusting the transaction price of a future contract.
If you enter into one.
If we enter into that contract.
Sorry, I'm slightly confused, and I'm trying to find the exact paragraph in 15, but that sounds to me a little bit like what we used to deal with in IFRIC 13 on loyalty programs and things like that, where there's a promise in the contract that part of what you're paying for now is going to give you some benefit for that future contract. And I may be mistaken, but...
I think your example is actually a very valid one. I think we are creating a hypothetical revenue transaction. We need to see it as a hypothetical revenue transaction. And to Peter's point, it's probably a very unlikely one because of the fact that there's an inherent uncertainty in it. But I think essentially that is a good base position to start from. And then the question we've got to ask ourselves is, by adding the regulator on top,
exactly,
have we sufficiently strengthened the non-recognition that we would probably get under the hypothetical revenue transaction, such as to decide that we now think that that addition of the regulator makes the economics sufficiently different? And I think that is the right question to ask.
Because it's different to prepayment, because it's not for this service, it's for next period.
You have essentially no contractual right to it.
Yeah.
And does the regulator...
The regulator
still doesn't provide you with a contractual right. What they do is they increase the, it places an additional framework on top of the transaction, which means that you have some greater expectation that the cash will flow. Is that sufficient to step into
a new... If the service is provided, then it's true.
Correct.
Then
Mary?
Let me start with a different example to differentiate from Steve's. Because I think it helps to illustrate the different kinds of contractual rights and obligations you can have. If you look at, it was prompted a bit by paragraph 9, if you think about a not unusual circumstance for many utilities where I can either pay the monthly or quarterly bill based on actual, or I can agree to pay a flat rate every month, you know, that levels it out with, let's say, an annual true-up, that, you know, a utility might be required or elect to give me that option to pay £100 a month for electricity, even though my electricity use might be £80 one month, £120 another. In that contract, the utility has to settle up with me, the customer, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of a period for how my flat monthly payments compare with what I actually consumed mm-hmm. in the period, and there's a scheduled mechanism for adjusting that and then for setting the next year, the next 6 month flat rate based on the revised estimate. And when I look at the table in paragraph 8, you know, this graphic is a reminder, that reminds me that in the right-hand leg between the rate-regulated entity and the entity's customers, there may be true-up arrangements like the one I just described that relates to the existing customer contract. And that's something that I think IFRS 15 copes with, caters to, is within the scope of that standard. Now, when I look, I think, again, it's very useful to keep repeating this diagram to remind us about what's special about, you know, this case that we're trying to address. And when there's a lot that I agree with in the paper, and I think we are pursuing development of the right model, but when I look at this paper and I think about especially question B or question 2 that you ask at the end, I'm not there yet in terms of, I feel Scottish in terms of saying not proven as opposed to I disagree in terms of, have you demonstrated in this paper that we have got to the point of demonstrating satisfaction of the conceptual framework asset and liability definition. In the analysis in this paper, I think it's the right question to look at, but I think what we haven't done yet and what I'd like to see come back is more in terms of knitting together the different characteristics that you identify in paragraph 23 in terms of how in combination, and this is where we kind of come to Steve's point about putting the regulator on top differentiates that, you know, that one transaction, the kind of cost plus transaction from why we now get to recognition of an asset and liability. I think we will be able to prove it, but I think one of the things we haven't explored enough in here is the implication of a regulator saying to me as a regulated entity, you provide this, you know, good or service under my regulation pursuant to the regulatory agreement, and I will not let others compete with you. And I think that is one of the elements we haven't brought out in terms of the asset and liability definition, in terms of why I control something that somebody else doesn't. Because I keep coming back to, have I really convinced myself yet? Sorry, have we proven yet that the right to increase prices in future, or the obligation to decrease prices in future, is actually a resource to me? And that's what I want to see grounded a bit more. I have some other comments I wanted to make about the paper, but I don't know, Sue, it looks like you wanted to thump me over the head about them.
I don't want to thump you over the head about anything at all. I'm certainly
but
not.
You're welcome to do so.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask you, so when I asked the question about how Jane was thinking about the transfer of economic resources in the sort of less profit but not onerous example, she responded to me saying that sort of thinking of the contract being in two parts. So one part's the contract with the customer at the normal profit, and then there's sort of a subpart which you call a sort of a unit of account type question, where I've got an obligation to provide a service for which, in a sense, I have to pay 50. So that little piece of the contract is almost like an onerous contract if you look at it in isolation. Yeah. Yeah? Does that help you?
I'm not sure, because when I go back to my anchoring diagram in paragraph 8, I think that's taking the two legs and trying to fold up the stool as if it were all one transaction. And I think the regulated entity has a contractual relationship with its customers. And what you're focusing on in that 50 is the rate regulated entity's relationship with its rate regulator, where the regulator is specifying how much profit it can make. And I think, you know, some of the fundamental conclusions that are in this paper that I want to say I agree with, and I think we should keep building on, is this the two legs of this transaction, of the two legs of the activities that this entity engages in, I think should be accounted for separately rather than combined. And so I think we're looked right to look at it and say, what are the additional rights and obligations that come out of the regulatory agreement?
What's trying to do when she thinks about it being in two units of account?
Something we have reached that conclusion.
Well,
some time ago.
Okay, that wasn't how I heard her explanation
Because when you said it felt like it was putting the two together,
yeah.
I see it almost as pulling the two apart so that you can see the supplementary piece as a separate transaction.
Yes. Okay. Because I think it's right to keep them apart, and I think it's important to be accounting for the regulatory agreement, which is, I think, the piece that we see missing. And I think just what's hard and confusing as we work through the logic in terms of things like the conceptual framework elements definition is that I have rights and obligations in this left-hand leg, but the collection mechanism is via my separate customer contract, and sometimes the collection mechanism creates noise that's hard for the logic. Now, on this intangible, not intangible, absolutely agree we should not be pursuing an IS 38 single intangible model, but I think the types of rights and obligation that you get out of the regulatory agreement are individually more like intangible assets because they're not financial assets because of this collection mechanism. And so I think we should avoid being absolutely dispositive in terms of they're not intangible assets or obligations. But I think our point is that we're absolutely not pursuing the IS 38 single model, and therefore we're only accounting for the individual adjustments rather than the arrangement as a whole. And that's, you know, that's I think a very clear decision that we've reached so far. But it shouldn't lead us to saying, but they're not intangible assets, because I think these adjustments are, because their rights to charge or obligations to reduce prices is, I think, through the limited array of the nature of items that we have, the closest thing is intangibles. Yeah. They're not tangible and they're not financial. So
see, this is not the first time that we are dealing with sort of intangible assets and that we refuse to call it so, just to stay away from IAS 38, which the creator of this, of that standard has said himself that it was a broken standard. Makes you pause and think, isn't it something that we should look at a certain point?
Sometimes we need more specific targets.
Not in this.
That's
project.
How I respond.
Yeah. And we have that flexibility now because we're doing a from scratch project as opposed to trying to interpret something or amend something or do a tweak. So let's not be scared of taking that step away from IS 38.
Yeah.
I'm a little hesitant about one of the things Françoise was saying, and you said about identify the nature, and you said that's what we were saying we want in paragraph 57 we wanted to do, because again, I think it's very helpful, and I think this came out in our last month's meeting, to say because revenue comes from the application of IFRS 15 and what the entity charges its customers, we aren't going to adjust revenue for the rights and obligations that come out of the contract, although they may adjust the profit. And so I think we can think about what gives rise to the adjustments, but I think by saying it's a revenue adjustment or a cost adjustment, we're going to send an incorrect signal that we're planning as a result to adjust the cost of assets or the amount of revenue when that's just the basis on which the rate regulation calculates what the regulatory adjustment is. So when Françoise was saying, I think we should spend more time identifying them as revenue adjustments or cost adjustments, I can see making sure we understand the source, but I don't want to signal that we're going to start adjusting those two. And I'm particularly sensitive to it because I think people would think of current U.S. GAAP as being revenue adjustments and cost adjustments, and I don't want to send an incorrect signal that we might be moving in that direction when I don't think we are.
Yeah.
So as I go through these, as I said, I think we need to maybe work a bit more on the items in paragraph 23 and how their interaction comes back to support the analysis versus the elements definition. And I think one of the things we may want to look at, again, from the discussion paper, is whether or not the characteristic of being essential in the context of the environment in which it operates. By, for example, water service may be essential in country one, but not considered an essential public good in country two. Whether being essential is part of what combined with the keeping out competitors, which is, I think, 23E, let's have a discussion so we decide whether or not we need that characteristic when we come back to analysis of the elements. And I think we're on the right track in terms of saying supplemental because it's layering on accounting for the regulatory agreement. And I think we're on the right track in terms of saying it's the individual items rather than saying because there's this regulatory agreement, it's a single intangible asset that we're accounting for. It's the adjustments. So those are the where I think we're on the right track and where I think we need more work in terms of what I'd like to see brought back.
Wait, what?
Is it better to...
No. We need your insights right now.
Last first. The Mary said, you know, maybe I'm wrong, you know, she had not seen the model yet. I fully agree with. You know, we just circle back whether meet definition as a liability. And we have not generated recognition criteria and the measurement presentation. We already argue with each other whether should link to revenue costs or simple last, you know, additional line in the balance sheet or income statement. And the impairment, recoverability. We have not, you know, specified all these things yet. So hard for me to say that I agree or not, whether we already have the model. And back to the beginning, the foundation, I think for me, two bases for me to generate a model. That is, one is the scope. We start with a very simplistic definition of regulatory environment. It is easier from beginning to justify whether there is an enforceable rights obligation. But I personally feel it is not realistic. You know, put into a practice and it will not work. People will say it will not win. And a long time ago, I once challenged during a board meeting, said, asked the staff, said, whether in UK there is any company meet the definition, the criteria. And still feel puzzled. Why you ask this question, you know? It is real issue, the scope. Because, you know, different scope, we have different variants of the right obligations. And will result in different recognition and measurement, you know, models, which people may agree or not. This is the first fundamental issue for me. The second fundamental issue is, I, to some extent, follow what Taka just said. You know, we have is going to have a new conceptual framework. We already clearly said new conceptual framework will not change too much, you know. Of course, we'll change something, but we'll not change too much. My understanding is we split the some parts of the things or concept in the old definition of asset liability elements, like probability and others, into recognition and measurement part. But as a whole, we put definition, recognition, measurement together, the conclusion may be the same. My worry is for this project or in the future, anytime when we start to discuss whether we should recognize something or not, we first look at definition and simply conclude it meets. And like Taka said, there is a potential. And therefore, we come out a clear conclusion. People feel excited, you know. But in this case, or maybe in the future, I will not think we should go this way. And we should put the definition, recognition, and measurement together to think about. Now come back to this paper about, because we are discussing about definition. I feel a few doubts. Firstly, is the uncertainty. How uncertainty should be considered when we discuss about, you know, whether we meet definition or not. And from asset point of view, we still have two basic elements of the concept in the asset definition. One is control, and another one is past event. I challenge you, you know, whether, you know, these two are qualified. And I opened the dissent opinions, you know, in 2009, Steve and I had. I'm not sure still whether you still hold. So we first challenge whether, you know, regulator can ensure the demand. You know, we deny, you know, cost, the customer basis and others, and we deny, you know. And in addition, we clearly said, furthermore, in practice, you know, the pattern of cash flow is often complicated by using estimated rather actual cost established rates. And to approve deferred debit or deferred credits. Secondly, time lag between submission and approval. Sometimes it takes years, you know. Thirdly, difference between expected and actual transaction volume, you know. And fourthly, different class of customers subject to different rates. And next, activities that are subject to different regulations. You know, we're talking about British Gas, you know. Not only, you know, provide one narrow scope of service, they will provide a different kind of service. And they may subject to different regulations. And as a result, you know, we said, you know, it is hard to find clear direct link between, you know, for example, the collapse of dam or incur something and the possible rate adjustment by the regulator. So from that point of view, you know, I feel hard to say, you know, it meets definition because you can control. And from liability side, we'll have similar problems. And this is one. And secondly, as to liability, you know, Sue challenged about refund, you know, or obligation to transfer resource. And actually, you know, I still remember clearly when FSB developed the current standards in the 70s, and among seven board members, three dissented, including the chairman and vice chairman. And one of the dissenters was Rob Sprouts. He was the one of the founders of the current conceptual framework. And he challenged the notion of refund. How can you describe a reduced rate you will charge to the customer as refund, as obligation to transfer resources? I feel hard to describe in such a way. If everybody interested, you can refer to Sprouts' dissent opinion in 70s. And finally, you know, the new conceptual framework definition both have past effect. I feel hard to think about when you should book the adjustment. In the case of the collapse of dam, is the collapse of the dam or rebuild the dam or the future, you know, the decision by the regulator, I feel very hard to imagine. Of course, if everything is predetermined at the beginning, day one, it's okay, very simple, you know. The actual rate is 10, government already said, you know, if something happens, you can increase one or decrease one. Everything is clear. But, you know, I don't think in electives it is so clear. And this is why we use the concept like chewing up, you know, reversal and others. And if you put these things together, I feel when is the past event, you should recognize those deferred debit credit. I still feel hard. So in conclusion, you know, back to the first questions as Mary just raised, you know, I not see whether the model is there.
Stephen, do you still have those views that you so clearly expressed in your dissenting opinion in 2009? What's different now? Is there anything different?
Well, 8 years of being on this board.
Mellowed.
This is mellow.
I mean, what we wrote at the time, it's still perfectly valid. I think you can take that view. But I think taking a more sort of the value sort of orientation on the value of the license and the value of the adjustments, I think you can get to a different answer. I mean, it's not easy. There is no definitive right and wrong answer in this. But I do agree with something particularly that Weigrier said. You said about it's 10 and you've got the right to charge more, charge less. I think the great difficulty is knowing what the 10 is versus the plus 1 and minus 1. Is the 10, 10 and a half or 9.5? We seem to assume that the 10 is obvious, but I think in reality it's actually very difficult to know what is the base and what is the true up.
Yes.
And I'm not sure we've really established that. We're just assuming that the true up adjustment is easy to identify. And that was part of what we said, that it's difficult to know what is this adjustment and to what it applies.
I mean, can I add? You follow what Steve, you just said. You're absolutely right. You know, when I...
Well, he just agreed with you, so of course he's...
Actually, in the period when Abner helped him a lot, that part, I still keep the communication with Wen, you know, during that time. And Wen said, you know, like you said, you know, the actual or not, you know, the billing rate or not, or adjusted rate, is used purely for, you know, formulating some kind of the stable return of profit. It's a process for the regulator to help you to calculate a stable rate of return for regulatory purpose. And whether this can be used for accounting purpose is totally different. And we have a separate paragraph in our dissent opinion, but maybe wording slightly differently.
Can I just sort of clarify a couple of points there? I mean, I think one big difference between the previous ED is that there wasn't the analysis that we've tried to do on how the regulation actually works and what are the rights and obligations created by the regulation. And I accept to an extent that there's a lot of judgment involved in precisely what's the base rate versus what's the adjustment. But the regulatory agreements that I've read, and believe me, I have read thousands of pages of regulatory agreements, regulatory instructions, reports from companies to the regulators, there's a huge amount of work goes into tracking the base rate and the adjustments. And when we talk next time about the reversing out of these, so once a regulatory balance, whether it's an asset or liability or just a regulatory debit or credit balance, whichever view you've got, once one of those is recognised, there is then a question of timing as to, as we're charging the rate in the future, how does that balance then get taken back out again? And there are assumptions that tend to be made in the real world that those balances come through first in the rate that's being charged, and then new originating differences are created because we've got these two components in the rate that we describe in paragraph 12. So there is some judgment, there is some simplifying assumptions and assertions in the rate, but people do this every day. You know, there are spreadsheets, some of the rate regulators, Weigrier, you keep mentioning the UK, some of the regulators in the UK actually provide the spreadsheets that companies have to use to track through the adjustments that are then reviewed and audited and pored over to come up with the rate calculation. So, you know, it's not simple, but it's what people live with every day.
Big Wolf, final rebuttal.
Now, unless there are fundamental changes of regulatory environment, or people have totally different imaginable or revolutionary ideas, you know, Jen, I will agree with you, you know, there are something there, you know, I will not deny there are something clear, but on the other hand, you know, I still be maybe, as Hans said, I'm quite stubborn, you know. I don't feel things change from 2009 fundamentally, and you see some clearer pictures, and I see some unclear pictures. And also please reread the commentary summaries analysis by another Martin about 7 years ago or 10 years ago. And I think it is worthwhile for us to read his summary, and he already gave us very clear pictures, what people's respond to us. And
yeah, when Steve came with his example of the cost plus, I felt, well, I have definitely too simplistic an approach to this subject to see to be easy with definitions of assets and liabilities, and also, in fact, all the questioning that Mary puts would bring me on that path. Nevertheless, I think we, in those customers that we're considering, we are considering customers who do not have the right to set a price for themselves. So normally when you consider a contract, you have two parties and they both agree on whatever has to be delivered and the price for it. And that ability of the customer to set the price is not there. So when I said to me, I see an economic interdependency between the successive customer contracts because of a regulatory agreement that, in my view, produces similar effects to the combination of contracts that we have in I-15. And if I support, I mean, I fully support the fact that we have this supplementary approach because I think it's important to, and it brings clarity and transparency into the model. But basically, if I have this simplistic approach to the subject, it's because of this economic interdependency. So to me, the contractual rights are there through the regulatory agreement, even though the customer has not even yet decided to consume further. The other point I would like to show, because I'm not sure I've read paragraph 57 exactly in the same way as Mary had. To me, what paragraph 57 says is that we have agreed on having the supplementary approach, basically. So we consider the relationship between the customer and the entity as the outcome of IS-15. And then we have a supplementary approach whereby we recognize supplementary assets and liabilities that, in fact, arise from that economic interdependency and the regulatory agreement. But to me, we have not reached any decision as to how this would be presented, mm-hmm. and whether we would have one regulatory asset and one regulatory liability, or two types of those. And I would like to keep those discussions open, depending on how we develop in recognition measurement on those.
Carol?
I think some of the stuff I was going to say is probably passed by already, but a couple of comments from me. I think the first one is I agree completely with those people who say we shouldn't be pinning any development of this model on changes to the conceptual framework. I don't think that's got anything to do with where we're going with this. I think rather what we're trying to do is say, well, if, and maybe my personal view here, if I look at these types of entities and their activities that they have, from an economic perspective, I would recognize that they probably have assets and liabilities, and I would probably price those in to a decision to buy or sell. So I think in the broader economic sense, I think we probably do have assets and liabilities in these entities. The question then from an application of the conceptual framework comes down to the point that I think Wego was making, is the control issue and the reliability issue. And to me, those things talk us back into the idea of the limitation of scope that you've spoken about. Because what you're doing is you are limiting the scope here to those where we do have sufficient knowledge about the underlying numbers, sufficient knowledge about whether we have control and what we mean by control. I always find the control concept quite difficult because I think there are a lot of things we recognize as assets where control is not the normal way we think about control, and I think we need to bear that in mind as we go through. to Weigo's issue about the dam and the dam collapsing, to me the trigger event is the collapse of the dam, because that's what triggers the potential for something to happen in the future. And that's the starting process of starting to think about it. The fact, and I agree 100% with Weigo, that there's a fundamental amount of measurement uncertainty is something we previously said, well, we live with measurement uncertainty. That's part of the process. And the fact that they're true-ups, well, that's what we live with in the accounting standards, is the fact that we true up, we re-estimate over time. So I don't think we should let those things stop us in terms of developing the process. I do think, a point from Weigo that I think is really important, I do think we need to, at some stage, probably quite early, establish the level to which we're comfortable that we are actually addressing, because of these scope limitations, a reasonable population. And I think we at least need to get some comfort that there are a few people out there, or that there are a certain number of transactions out there that will benefit. But for me, it's that control criteria, that reliability criteria that help us decide the scope, and then we move from there.
John Wu.
Thank you. De Francois, you suggest a very interesting idea about a series of successive contracts in future periods. That's responding to Steve's comment, hypothetical future transactions. So my thinking is, if your idea is right, if we apply IFRS 15, then can we recognize this total amount of a series of all successive contracts at the current period as a revenue?
No, I don't think you could do that with IFRS 15, because IFRS 15 considers that contract with the customer and does that only. And that's the reason why I'm supportive of this supplementary approach.
Yes, dear, I agree with you. The current IFRS 15 has some limitations in this issue. In other normal competitive market-based transactions, IFRS 15 produces very useful information on revenue. But however, in this case, it's a very special case. So the IFRS 15, maybe unfortunately, might not produce a very good information on this kind of revenue. So I would like to ask to Steve. So if there is some issue with that hypothetical future contracts at the current period, we do not know whether the contracts will be done or not. However, anyway, that's a very good point. However, is that issue is they're violating the kind of definition of an asset because of this kind of feature, that hinder our regulatory asset that meets the definition of asset in the conceptual framework?
I think that's the issue that has to be resolved.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Weigo would say
right. It
isn't an asset because we don't control our customer, future customers are going to buy some more goods from us. And if we don't control that, well, we can't control this asset. But if you think of the asset more as the arising from the regulatory agreement and it's something you've been granted by the regulator, then I think you can get to it being an asset. Because you have control of the rights under that agreement.
In combination with the customers having very little escape possibilities.
So that argument is quite similar to the dissenting opinion that Weigo explained just and Weigo made a dissenting opinion because of this issue. Control the Biden entity, whether this kind of thing. But at the time you raised another factor demanding uncertainty rather than hypothetical future transactions.
counter. I think it's the same thing.
Or the same thing, right, right. Yes, but as Mary said, if this is a kind of a three-way transactions, not just one between the entity and the customer, one customer, if the regulator comes in this setting, so it's quite peculiar setting that's very special, that's what I'm saying. So our conceptual framework is a very good one, but my personal view is that conceptual framework is not strong enough to cover this special situation. So that's one, that's another kind of a limit, it seems to be limitation of the conceptual framework. And also there's a limitation of the IFRS 15, as you said, what is the basic rate and the kind of adjust, what are these? Now actually these two, the basic price and there are some adjustment, seems to me a really different phenomena that was not that well in the our conceptual framework and the and IFRS 15. So that's one thing. And another thing is this some effect of hypothetical future contracts. If we see intangible model of service concession agreement, in that transaction, still we are recognizing some kind of intangible asset. I'm saying that the amount of intangible asset depends on the future hypothetical transactions. But the setting is a little different from this and the service concession arrangement, the intangible model of this. So there, if we think of that intangible model in the service concession agreements, so that hypothetical future contract, whether we can control that hypothetical transaction or not, might not affect that the nature of the regulatory asset. So that's my idea on your suggestion of the hypothetical transaction problem.
Amaro?
Thanks, Hans. Few comments only at this stage. And first, I think the challenge that we will pose before us are important because this indicates points that we really need to be comfortable in advancing. Although I would not incentivize us to continue discussing if we are considering this under the new or the old conceptual framework, because I think this is past. We developed a new conceptual framework and it's, I don't think it's really constructive for us keep going back to the old conceptual framework. This is first thing. So I would incentivize us to focus on the new one as the staff tried in this paper. This is the first thing. Keeping asking us why we did something in 2009, why we believe it might be distinct at this point, is also I don't think it's constructive. And I will say why. The model in 2009 was basically a cost recovery model. And it was limited in terms of what we knew at the time about the existence of these rate-regulated agreements. So I think during these 8 years and during the IFRS 14 and the DP, the first DP, we learned that there are loads of rate regulatory regimes. And that's my next point. That's why we the staff identified the characteristics that are in paragraph, I forgot the paragraph here.
23.
But, yeah, 23. And those characteristics will be key to for us to reach the first point to go ahead with this project, or at least to develop an NDP of this project, is the scope. So because the scope, when dealing with the scope, we are going to deal with the boundaries, I would call, of the concept of assets and liabilities for this particular type of transaction. As Daryl said, everyone that is involved with this industry do know and do price the economic resources that are derived from the regulatory agreement. Everyone, absolutely everyone. Are those going to be recognized as asset liabilities? This comes under the control issue, basically. So this is the first step for us. So we need to have a clear scope that will be somewhat, in my view, I expect to be responsive to the challenge posed by Weigu. I think some of the challenges are actually, at least in my mind, out of the scope, already not into the scope, like the time lag between submission and approval. So we learned that we are not focused on regulatory agreements that, you know, I submit a request and I expect to have the benefit of the regulator authority. No, it's not. We are talking about contract. We are trying to establish a scope that clearly give us a better boundary between what is contractual and what is not contractual. So I think it's important to have this very clearly. As for discussions on intangibles or IFRS 15, I think we as a board, we need to leave this behind us. Are we going to explore IFRS 15? I don't believe so. If we keep going discussing between, is this an adjustment to figure to IFRS 15, we are not leave this room ever, because there will be always a discussion, is this cost recovery, it's complementary in terms of adjustment to this figure. So I think it would be good for us to really concentrate in what we are trying to portray. What we are trying to portray is the rights and obligations that are derived from the contract between the rate regulated entity and the rate regulator. Let's focus on this. It's the only way for us to go ahead. Are we going to discuss intangibles? Of course, if these are economic resources acknowledged for everyone in pricing, of course, and are not recognizing, they are, of course, a type of intangible. But we discuss intangible in our literature, we are going to discuss IAS 38. And if we are going to do this, is another scope. It's another thing. We discussed this back in 2009, and we reached a concord or IFRS 14, and we decided that, no, we are not going to go back to intangible. It's another project, it's another scoping. We are trying to really capture something that's a right and obligation. And why we are here? Because we have IFRS 14. We have to explore this. And the staff believe, and I agree with staff, there is room to explore under the conceptual framework, not new or old, under the conceptual framework that we are about to publish, there's a possibility eventually to recognize assets and liabilities. Later on, we are going to discuss measurement, and then we'll bring uncertainty in issue. On the measurement is another thing. At the end of the day, the value can be zero, no problem. That's life with accounting. But recognition is the first step. Scope is absolutely important. Let's concentrate on scope in the present conceptual framework. That's the one we are going to apply.
Mary?
Two follow-ups. One, let me endorse Amaro's comment about let's focus on the definitions of the elements that we expect to publish later this year, for which we have completed our re-deliberations, and let's not invest time in old versus new. It's just we absolutely should do an analysis versus the conceptual framework, given that we've done our re-deliberations. And what we're trying to get to is a DP, presumably, you know, it's proposals rather than final. I think we can anticipate the publication in this circumstance, and it isn't an argument about whether it would be different. Let's not invest in the would it be the same or different. Let's make one analysis, and I think looking forward is the right framework for doing that. The other thing is maybe a bit of a different spin on the point about measurement uncertainty that I've heard today. Again, if I go back to that anchoring diagram, I think we actually might need a new label for it in terms of the three-way interdependent relationship. I think we need to say it's two separate but related relationships, because
we already went away from the three.
But we still got that label on it. So maybe we have to think about that part. But the thing is, there was a lot of debate about what can we identify the base amount versus the adjustment. There's measurement uncertainty. There are estimated amounts that will be trued up later. If you look at the right-hand side of that leg, there is absolutely no uncertainty. You know, it might be I might have to pay in advance or I might pay monthly, but there's no uncertainty once I know how much my Q is about what, you know, what the P is, and there's no comeback for me. There's no measurement uncertainty in that right-hand leg. And let's not confuse ourselves by saying there's measurement uncertainty about this entity's activities, because the measurement uncertainty comes all in the left-hand leg from the regulatory agreement. In the right-hand leg, there's not, and that's why we think IFRS 15 applies, and IFRS 15 is capable of dealing with any estimates if you have to pay in advance and dealing with maybe credit uncertainty. So the measurement uncertainty comes only from the left-hand leg, and that's where we're dealing it, and that's where we're going to have to answer challenges like Wei Guo's. But let's not make it about the whole of the thing, because that, again, folds up those two legs, which should be out to support the model.
Can I add a final, about less than 10 words?
You already used 7.
I'm not sure. You know, Chung Wu discussed with me several days ago about whether the light side is sure at all.
All right. Well, Jane, do you want to give some final philosophical comments?
I guess. Well, what I will say is that clearly we haven't got to the clarity that I was hoping here, but perhaps I can just sort of forewarn people. In terms of the conceptual framework, we're not looking back at the old conceptual framework. As Gary said, what seems to be a lifetime ago, we've got this new conceptual framework, so we're trying to use this conceptual framework because we think it's more helpful in our analysis. We're not making judgments about whether it's different. It's just there's more guidance, there's more information in there, and that's what we're focusing on. I think Daryl picked up on a point about we have some assets in the balance sheet already that we don't actually think of those in terms of control. And I think there's something we mentioned in paragraph 34, I think. We're not talking about the economic benefits that are generated from the economic resources. We're talking about the economic resource being a right. We don't control customers buying stuff in the future, but we don't control them to buy our inventory or things like that. So it is a focus on we have a right, and we're controlling that right. We can't control whether people will buy stuff in the future. But I think coming back to a point that Francoise made and addresses Steve's point, in this environment that we're talking about, there's a very, very high probability that we are going to be having customers buying stuff in the future. And that's what the regulator is relying on. And I think he's looking at combining all of these customer contracts in a way that I think it does distinguish from the individual customer scenario that Steve was talking about, where we sign a contract that says, if there's any true up in this, we'll pick it up if you come back and buy some more goods. In that case, I can see that we maybe don't hit the combination of contracts section of IFRS 15. But the regulator here now is saying, actually, I am now setting these contracts today in a way that I am going to link to those contracts in the future through that regulated rate mechanism. So I think we have got a distinguishing feature in that respect. And so the next time we come back, we'll try and pick up on some of these points about the drivers for some of these adjustments, maybe picking up on other aspects of the conceptual framework. I don't think we can ignore the conceptual framework. We have done quite a lot of research in this project. We've issued a request for information. We've issued published a discussion paper. We had nearly 100 comment letters back to the request for information, over 100 comment letters back from the discussion paper. As I mentioned earlier, I have read thousands of pages worth of regulatory documentation. We've done outreach. We've had other standard setters that have been doing outreach in different countries. So we know that regulation exists with the adjustment mechanism that we've described in the paper. And as far as the scope, that's the only thing that we're proposing at this stage that the model is going to account for, is the adjustments coming out of that adjustment mechanism. We've been through, as MRSAs, we've been through the debates that the regulation could have a much wider economic effect because we have got a right to increase prices in the future, but then everybody's got a right to increase prices in the future. That's not what we're trying to account for. That's part of the goodwill, the value of the business as a whole. What we're trying to do is add some value to the users of financial statements in providing them with something that we know about is going to affect those future cash flows. And in terms of the measurement uncertainty, it's not as though all of the numbers in this left-hand side that Mary talked about coming out of the regulation have got measurement uncertainty. Some of these adjustments are very objective, they're very mechanical. The bookkeeping systems show what the numbers are. So I think in terms of existence, we haven't got the uncertainty. What we're looking at there is recoverability and looking at the predictability of the customer patterns, which I think is a measurement issue, not an existence of the assets or the liability type of issue. And I think it's important that we try and keep those distinctions in mind, and I'll try and put those more clearly into future papers to help us to focus on different aspects of uncertainty and how they play together, and come back and talk about the combination of the characteristics and how they can work together.
All right, thank you.